City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is the impact of sports-related head injuries. This weekend, the 49ers will play in the NFC Championship here in San Francisco. The winning team will go to the Super Bowl. The players demanding top dollar are bigger and faster, making the hits and tackles more dangerous. Indeed, the Center for Disease Control has concluded sports concussions have reached an epidemic level. Between 1.6 and 3.8 million sports-related concussions occur in the United States each year, with links being drawn to depression, memory loss, and even suicide. What is it about the concussion that makes it so dangerous? Is there anything that can be done to minimize the long-term damage of such hard and frequent hits? Or is there any chance that coaches and players at the NFL, college, and high school levels might change the way they play the game? Joining me to answer these questions and more are in studio Dr. Cindy Chang, Chief Medical Officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic team in London, President of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and former head physician of Cal Athletic Department from 1995 to 2008. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you.
And also we have Dr. Eric Freitag. He's a psychologist and clinical neuropsychologist, credentialed impact consultant, and founder and executive director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having us.
And last, we have Ben Lynch, former Cal and NFL offensive lineman. He played for the 49ers for the last 4 years. You can probably guess who he wants to win this playoff game. And, of course, we'll be taking calls from you. Give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So I'd like to start tonight with Eric Freitag. Eric, your memory center has a specific program dedicated to sports concussions. Maybe you can just let us know up front, what exactly defines a concussion?
That's a great question. A concussion is basically when you have some sort of violent blow to the head or to the body that causes the brain to move inside the skull violently or shake violently. Or it causes a rapid acceleration and deceleration of the brain inside of the skull.
So how does one get one?
Well, just to expand on that a little bit more, is once you have that sort of traumatic blow, and then it causes an alteration in the way that your brain works. It disrupts brain function, whether you lose consciousness, which actually only occurs in about 10% of cases, or you have other symptoms such as feeling foggy, dizzy, or out of it, or neurological symptoms like a headache or blurred vision or nausea. That, by definition, is a concussion.
Well, that sounds kind of vague. I always thought that you don't have a concussion unless you pass out. So if you have these other symptoms, I mean, that could be a lot of different things. How would a player know that it's a concussion when they see blurry, you know, something as opposed to something else?
Well, right. It is a common misconception that you need to pass out or lose consciousness in order to have a concussion. But you have to look at, was there a mechanism of injury? Meaning, was there a blow to the head or was there a blow to the body that causes this violent rocking of the head? And then if you have that sort of mechanism of injury and then subsequently have these symptoms, this brain dysfunction, that by definition is a concussion injury or a suspected concussion has occurred.
Okay. Is it always the same amount of impact that causes a concussion?
Not at all. Our brains are designed differently. Some athletes can take tremendous amount of force or take a tremendous blow and not have a concussion injury. Other athletes take minimal amounts of contact, and they will have signs and symptoms that are consistent with a concussion.
Okay. And Cindy Chang, do you want to add to this, Dr. Cindy Chang?
Yeah, I totally agree with Dr. Freitag. I do want to point out that some of the data that shows that loss of consciousness is involved in 5 to 10% of concussions, I still think that number is high. I believe there are a lot of concussions that go unreported, and I believe that that number of unconscious, where you lose consciousness, is much lower than even 5%. The other thing that we need to, this is why education is so important, is that sometimes symptoms don't appear immediately after that trauma that we've witnessed, whether that's a parent in the stands or the coach or the team physicians or the athletic trainer. The symptoms don't appear right away, and they will appear an hour to 4 hours later, depending on the inflammation and the changes that are going on in the brain.
So that's really interesting. Then do you find that is the damage always permanent, or is it do you have to is the damage, like, how much does it, of a difference does it make in terms of damage whether you pass out or you don't pass out? If you pass out, does that mean it's really bad, or
no, not necessarily? And then certainly the different symptoms will oftentimes reflect what parts of the brain were injured, because different parts of the brain control different aspects of our neurocognitive function, our visual system, our balance system, RAS, the reticular activating system. That is what controls consciousness. But oftentimes I've had a couple patients that have passed out, but upon regaining consciousness have no signs or symptoms of a concussion at all. And we watch them very carefully over the next few days as well, and they don't exhibit any type of symptoms of what Eric talked about. Mm-hmm. So it is very different, and it's very individualized. And therefore, as a healthcare professional, we can't right away say, oh, that's a bad concussion, or that's a good concussion, or that's a good head injury, you'll be okay, mild versus moderate. It's really difficult to use those terminology until a few days, even a day or two after the head injury.
Okay, great. Eric, why are they so dangerous?
Well, they're dangerous when they're mismanaged. One thing I tell a lot of parents of athletes that I see and talk about in groups, that a concussion in and of itself, as an isolated injury, is really not that big of a deal. On the whole, it is a benign, what we call benign neurological event. Kind of a provocative statement, but it is true that our brains, if we manage them properly, allow them to heal, and ensure that the brain has recovered before the athlete has returned to sports or other types of activities, the brain will recover. And the overwhelming majority of these injuries, the brains will experience a full and normal recovery. It's just when they're mismanaged and the brain is allowed to be re-injured and re-injured over and over again is where we're starting to run into problems like we're seeing in the NFL.
Okay, so that would be true about any body part, right?
Exactly. Our brain follows effectively the same mm-hmm. physiological rules and principles that the rest of our body does. If we look at Golden State Warrior guard Stephen Curry with his ankle injury, that is an injury that has been injured over and over and over again, and now he's starting to show some pretty significant damage and symptoms from it. Our brain's the same way.
Okay. Cindy, let me go back to you for a second. You've helped top-notch collegiate athletes now for almost 20 years, right?
So, yes.
So why do you think that there's a rise in awareness and concern of the concussion?
Well, Eric and I and Ben and I have been talking about this, and we're ecstatic that head injuries are finally getting the attention they deserve. You see these waves of publicity for certain types of things, steroids, other conditions, and it is driven, I believe, by the NFL. And 20 years ago when I started sports medicine, it was really a challenge to get coaches and athletes and families to really understand what it was to have a concussion and what it meant and why we were being conservative with their return to play. Now, with the awareness of the NFL, there's the Youth Sports Safety Coalition, there's a lot of organizations, including AMSSM, where we are really trying to get that message out that this is a big deal. And like Eric said, these don't have to be permanent. This does not have to be a permanent injury. If it's recognized and managed well, people will recover, and you don't have to be cautious about playing different sports because of it. But it's very important that we recognize it and we treat it appropriately.
So do you feel that they're, would you say that they're avoidable, or the mismanagement is avoidable?
I think both. I think definitely both. To be able to recognize, and that's oftentimes very hard. When you have a concussion, a sports-related concussion, even if you've been educated about what that means, oftentimes your mental faculties are such that you don't think you have one, especially in the heat of the game, your adrenaline's going. And so it is really very important that the people around that athlete, his or her teammates, the athletic trainer on the sideline, parents, people in the stands, the referees and the umpires understand that what the signs and symptoms are, and they can also point that out in terms of, hey, there's something different about that athlete.
That feels okay. Well, let me bring in Ben Lynch. You are out there on the field knowing what it feels like. Do you want to add to what anyone has mentioned so far?
I just want to add to what Dr. Chang said. Mm-hmm. And there really isn't a wow moment as an athlete where you say, I've got a concussion. It may take minutes, it may take hours, it may take several days, but I don't think there's a clear-cut list of symptoms that an athlete can recognize when or when they haven't had a concussion. And I think that's something that, as somebody that got done playing football in 2003, I didn't know what a concussion was until after I'd retired from the game. Nobody told me that a headache was a symptom, blurred vision, nausea.
Wow.
I always thought a concussion was you had to be knocked unconscious. So along with this discussion, I think it's great that there's more awareness and athletes are finally being taught what a concussion is so they can recognize them going forward.
Now, tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, how was it different to play high school, college, and then NFL football?
The speed of the game obviously changes. At the high school level, there are smaller athletes, and the pace of the game is a little bit slower. And then at the collegiate level, it takes a step up where the athletes are obviously bigger. The speed of the game is quicker. And then when you reach the NFL level, which is just the pinnacle of play with the game of football, the athletes are so big and so strong, and the game is so fast-paced that there's just a tremendous amount of force every time you hit somebody or a tackle is made on the football field.
Were you ever scared when you went in, or does that even cross your mind?
I think that fear is part of it. It's a fight or flight response, and that gets your adrenaline going. So I think that everyone has that response before a game. I've seen people that get pumped up, and I think that adrenaline is part of the fight or flight response.
So do you think that in terms of tactically, I mean, are people at the high school, college, and NFL level kind of playing the same?
I think so. I think that a lot of the techniques that are used in the NFL are used at the high school level. I know when I was a high school player, I looked at NFL players, the players that I really looked up to. I tried to emulate their style of play. So I think it's important that the NFL set a precedent in terms of the way you treat and manage concussions. And up to this point, I see some real problems in the way they're doing things. And hopefully that will change, because I know that whether it's a collegiate coach, a high school coach, a high school player, that football is very much a copycat game, where whether it's a scheme, a certain technique, that players of all levels try to emulate what's working in the NFL level. And I think, unfortunately, right now, collegiate and high school medical staffs are emulating some of the things they see in the treatment and management of concussions at the NFL level.
Well, let me ask you, do you think you've had a concussion? I mean, you mentioned that you didn't even understand what it was until after, but in retrospect, do you think you ever had concussions during play?
Well, if you asked me this question in 2007, I would say I've never had a concussion. But now, knowing the definition, I would say I've had a lot of concussions. And when I have this discussion with former teammates, I ask them how many concussions they've had, and they start out maybe saying, I haven't had any, I've had one, I've had two. But then I talk to them about the symptoms that Eric discussed, and when I give them that definition, their eyes kind of light up and they realize just how many concussions they've had over the course of their career, and it's a little bit scary.
So you were a lineman, so how often do you think you took hits to the head during a normal game?
Every play. Okay. Just the nature of line play. If we have people out there that are football fans, you know that offensive linemen and defensive linemen are down in a three-point stance, and the two points of their body that are closest to one another are their helmets. So just by virtue of the way you line up in that stance, the two closest points are the helmets, and oftentimes those are the two points that hit first. So I think that those are two positions that really take a lot of hits to the head during the course of a football season.
And do you find that you mentioned the depression? So did it come and go, or was it accumulative? I mean, it's a lot of hits.
I had one episode in training camp, and training camp is rough. It's two-a-day football where you're practicing twice a day. It's hot. We were out in Stockton for training camp. It was 110 degrees. And I remember a certain episode where I didn't feel like getting out of bed. And I don't think anyone wants to get out of bed during training camp. You'd much rather stay in bed. But I didn't care what the coaches said, what my teammates said. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to get out of bed and tomorrow I'll feel better. Just like an ankle sprain goes away, progressively feels better. But I had a few days where the symptoms got worse as the days went on. And eventually I went to see a mental health professional outside of the team because I thought it was a mental health issue and I didn't want to embarrass myself going to a trainer or a team doctor. But I sought help outside of the team medical staff to address some of these issues. And within a few months, the symptoms resolved themselves. But again, it's something that I worry about in the future. Those symptoms will come back because obviously the cumulative effect of those hits to the head don't fully take effect until later on in life, as we've seen with so many athletes. NFL players are getting older.
Eric, is this a common story? Have you heard this before?
Well, absolutely, and that's one thing I wanted to point out, that after a concussion, the way our brains regulate and modulate our mood can oftentimes be affected. And it's extremely common that an individual can have mood symptoms such as depression or anxiety. And it's even more common that I'll ask athletes, how they're feeling, how they're doing. They say, I just cry for no reason at all. I don't understand. And it's just because the brain's ability to regulate what we call our affect or regulate our mood becomes dysfunctional as well as a part of that recovery process. So it's a very common symptom. Not with everybody, but it is a very common symptom.
And you work with these athletes. So what kind of treatment do you do with them? I mean, I think you've all mentioned that, it's the management of the concussion that's the most important part. So by the time, Eric, that you see people, is it too late? Has it been mismanaged? Or are there things that you can do to help?
Well, it's never too late. I mean, certainly the earlier we can start treating them and manage them properly, the better. But the management approach is really a comprehensive, a team-based approach where I would use neurocognitive testing to provide some sort of objective metric of which to measure how severe the injury is, and then also to monitor recovery over time. And then we also communicate in conjunction with their physician, such as their primary care or their neurologist, to help that manage physical symptoms such as headache and nausea, and whether medications are appropriate. And then we want to look at things in a really comprehensive manner. The most important thing to recover from a concussion is just to rest the brain. And that's easier said than done. And that oftentimes
Does the brain ever rest?
Well, especially for high school, for teenagers. And that really takes a lot of effort to really have a deep communication, deep conversation with the athlete and their parents saying, sports is actually the easiest thing to keep a lot of these kids away from. They understand that. They get that. They can't go back in because they don't want to re-injure their brain. But when I say, well, and you also can't go to school this week either. And I say, but I got AP. I have finals this week. And it's no, you need to rest that brain. You have to rest it from physical exertion as well as cognitive exertion. And by the way, that also means I don't want you on Facebook. I don't want you texting. I don't want you watching video games. But can I watch movies? Well, you can watch Beaches, but not The Matrix. You know, you have to just rest that brain. That is so important.
Okay. Ben, were you given advice like that?
Well, actually, I want to take a step back and talk about the identification of concussions. Sure. Just talk about a stat that I found amazing. In the NFL seasons from 1997 to 1999, so three seasons, there were 21 reported concussions, and that was an average of 7 concussions per season. And in 2010, there were 159 reported concussions. And then this past season, through the regular season, week 17 of the NFL season, there were 171 reported concussions. So that doesn't mean 171 concussions actually occurred in the NFL. That means how many were reported during the course of a season. And I think that as athletes are more and more educated, that number will continue to rise.
So it's really an awareness thing. What do you think, Cindy? Do you agree?
I don't totally agree. When my first season as Cal's head team physician was Ben's last in 1995. And at that point, I was coming on. It was my first season. We didn't really have an educational program set up. And as you can guess, coaches oftentimes don't want us to give the message of what bad can happen if you play football, of course. But by the following year and the year after, I was realizing that how we were managing concussions, there was more to it. There should be more to it. Because at that point, we were basing my evaluation of concussions on a neurological exam, how well I knew the student athlete, but also what they were reporting to me, what we call subjective signs and symptoms. And there had to be some other way that we could get to it. So I began to investigate neuropsychological testing. By virtue of starting some basic paperwork that I was having our athletes fill out, that started the educational process for them. And in terms of that, I saw myself more and more student athletes then reporting concussions to our staff because of the fact that they were increasing their awareness. And this has been fabulous because we started with football and then we expanded to other sports at Cal. This is happening at the high school level. So with the recent passage of a bill this fall, AB 25, and prior to that, this California Interscholastic Federation, CIF, had passed their own bylaw 313 a year prior to that, basically says that you need to pull a student athlete out of practice or competition if there's any suspicion that they have suffered a head injury. And along with that comes an educational piece, which they need to be given prior to the season starting, information on concussions that they and their parent or guardians need to sign prior to participating in a sport. So that piece of it is going to go a long ways towards increasing awareness and reportability of these concussions. And the statistics that Ben reports totally demonstrates that because it's become more prominent. Now it's the NFL is saying, okay, we've got the safety committee here. There's an NFL form we're going to use. They have initiated some changes with their medical staff that is going to improve concussions. I think that you see the numbers are going up in terms of reported concussions, and that's going to happen, I think, at the high school and college level as well.
So I want to loop back with a question, but before I do, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the impact of sports-related head injuries and the kind of efforts Bay Area medical practitioners are taking. Joining me tonight are Dr. Cindy Chang, Chief Medical Officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic team in London, President of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and former head physician of the Cal Athletic Department. Dr. Eric Freitag, founder and executive director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center, and Ben Lynch, former Cal and NFL offensive linesman, who also played for the 49ers for 4 years. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or joining us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. I want to hear from you. I don't know if there's any parents out there who are thinking, wait a minute, or maybe like, oh, now is the time to get my child in because the rules are better. Or if you are watching the football now with a different frame of mind, or maybe you're thinking, I don't care about the concussions. My team has to win. so we want to hear from you. And that's actually the direction I want to take you in, Cindy, for a second, which is, do you think that these new rules are going to make coaches a little bit uneasy because it's, you know, they just want their team to win. They want whatever it takes. And now you're kind of putting these cautionary notes and having, you know, if a player, if they're a good player, they thought that their player was still could be out there because he didn't pass out and the symptoms didn't seem that great. But now you're saying, you know what, you might have to take your star player and pull him out because he might have a concussion. What kind of pushback are you getting from these coaches?
Well, that's a great question. And certainly all of us here were or still consider themselves to be athletes. So, and we've coached in the past, and we certainly understand the desire to have the best team out there on the court, on the playing field. But if you can educate the coaches and tell them that this head injury could potentially mean that if they continue to play, that they're out much longer than just one game or 1 week, but out longer, 3 weeks or even the season, or ending their career, I think that that is a very strong emphasis that we have to make as a community in terms of realizing that if there's any doubt, and this is the mantra, when in doubt, sit them out, that the short-term versus long-term, and it's really hard. We live in a society where everything is immediate gratification and short-term, but we have to think long-term in terms of what can happen with injuries such as sports-related concussions.
What about you, Ben? I mean, knowing what you know, you're out there. It's the Super Bowl. Are you going to sit out?
That's tough for an athlete, but I even like to take it a step further in terms of ending an athletic career. Now we're talking about players committing suicide because they have these mental health issues, and I know people that I played against. Shane Dronette was a defensive lineman for the Atlanta Falcons who committed suicide not too long ago and had a history of head injuries. So it's not just careers on the line, but people's lives are on the line. And there is another former Chicago Bear that played on the great 1985 Super Bowl championship team, Dave Duerson, who committed suicide. And he actually shot himself in the chest and left a note saying, "I think there's something wrong with my brain. Please examine my brain." So he intentionally left his brain intact and shot himself in the chest so his brain could be examined. So I think there's some very heavy-duty consequences. And while athletes are very competitive, they want to be on the field for big games, I think as more and more information is getting out there, they'll realize that, hey, I've got a great family at home. I've got kids that I want to play with. Maybe I need to reevaluate playing with a head injury going forward.
Okay, and what do you think, Eric?
Well, I think looking at, you know, from the youth level, I work with a football coach up in Marin, our paths cross quite frequently. He's a great coach. And he says something I think is very poignant. And he says, you know, I don't coach football players. I coach future doctors. I coach future lawyers. I coach, future financial professionals. And nothing to me is more important than their brains, and nothing to me is worth risking their long-term brain health. And so to him, it's just not worth it. And I think more coaches follow that type of philosophy than not. It's just we hear about the small percentage that maybe are a little bit cavalier with their players' health that can be problematic.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. Tonight we're discussing the impact of sports-related head injuries and the kind of efforts Bay Area medical practitioners are taking. My guests tonight are Dr. Cindy Chang, Chief Medical Officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic team in London and President of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine and former head physician for the Cal Athletic Department, Dr. Eric Freitag, Founder and Executive Director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center, and Ben Lynch, former Cal and NFL offensive lineman, and he played for the 49ers for 4 years. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I like that we have several people on the line. So let me go to my first caller for the evening, Robert from San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, has any thought ever given to the idea that perhaps when it comes to high school students, maybe the risk is just too high playing football? I mean, we don't let kids drink alcohol because we recognize developing brains are different than adult brains, and yet we're letting them, we're encouraging them to play this game where they're banging their head around. I saw some study somewhere said even without a concussion, the constant banging of the head.
Robert, do you have a son or any children that be interested?
I do, but you know, I don't have the sports team, which is maybe why I'm asking the question. I'm not part of the football religion, and you know, my I come from a family of clubs, so I guess maybe I can ask that. But certainly, if I had a son who wanted to play football, I would probably put my foot down. I mean, it's just the risk is unacceptable. Again, one thing, an NFL player has a fully developed brain. We're talking kids who are still growing. And the idea that I think I saw something Tufts University or somewhere that even without a concussion, there could be some ongoing danger.
Okay, but let me throw this to
for high school students.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. Thanks for bringing it up. Let me throw this to Ben. What would you tell your son or?
The caller brings up a great point. We have a society that's decided that you have to be 21 years old to drink alcohol. You have to be 18 years old to buy a pack of cigarettes. A parent can't say, boy, my little Johnny is very responsible. I'm going to write him a note so he can go get a six-pack of beer, but he's only 14 years old. You can't do that. Our society has decided that you can't do that. So maybe our society needs to decide that the risk of playing football at a certain age is just too high for children. And maybe that's not even a decision that parents should make. Maybe it's a decision that our government needs to make. I'm not sure where it's going to go, but if you're a six-year-old kid that's out there playing Pop Warner, do you really have a sense of the long-term health effects that can come from multiple blows to the head or ongoing concussions? I don't think you do.
What about now? What about you, Cindy? What do you think? Is there anything that you're putting in writing as you're developing this policy or, you know,
This is interesting, especially in light of the Republican debates that have been on recently about freedom of choice. We talked about this, and I've talked about it with my colleagues, and I think in the end, if we start to put that restriction in terms of football, then what about rugby, and what about
driving a car, where there are definitely a greater instance of head injuries, there as well, and other types of activities that people take place, you know, motocross riding, all those things. And what do we start imposing? And I think that in the end, it comes down to the educational piece. In the end, it comes down to making sure that you're tackling correctly, making sure that you're avoiding lowering your head when you make a tackle, making sure that the kids, student athletes in high school or college or in the NFL, have their helmets on correctly, that they have them strapped down tightly, that there's enough air in their helmets when they're playing, and that we make sure that there are appropriate medical personnel on the sidelines at all these events that are observing and watching and pulling athletes if they suspect them of having any type of injury, because it's not just head injuries. It's also neck injuries that can happen. It's also fractures that can happen. And the sad fact is, in the state of California, we only 40% of our high schools have an athletic trainer that's on the sideline for football games. And less than that have a full-time athletic trainer for all the other sports, where wrestling, where concussions can occur. So the question is where do we draw the line?
Right. Let me go. We have a lot of calls. So let me go to Susie from Alameda. Sure. Hi, Susie.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the staff that you've pulled together there to interview. This is a wonderfully enlightening program, and I think it's something that comes to our mind a lot, but we don't discuss very openly. I quit watching football a long time ago because I had a knee injury, and it just made me understand pain. But I know that Dr. Daniel Amen is leading a big movement. He's on PBS on TV with his program, and he very, very much encourages people to not let their kids play football because of the head injuries. And I think he's got a brain clinic, at least a couple of brain clinics in the country. But I was specifically, my question was about this. One of my nephews fell and had an injury, very severe brain injury, and went into coma for some weeks about 2.5 years ago. A lot of people say he'll never be normal, he'll never do this, never do that. When I visited and back east, he seemed very normal to me, but he forgets to turn off the burner. There are many things. He can't drive a car. There are many things that he hasn't progressed to yet. But I'm hoping and encouraging him to not despair, that there will always be changes in the brain. And as time goes by, if he stays with his programs, he can do other things.
Susie, thank you for opening up and bringing this out. Let me take this throw this over to Eric Freitag. I mean, Eric, have you seen injuries to this degree, and what sort, you know, have people been able to improve?
Yeah, well, I have, and it's important to recognize that when we talk about brain injuries, we talk about ranges of severities. A concussion is typically synonymous with a mild traumatic brain injury, meaning it's characterized as an injury that will generally experience a full and successful resolution in the matter of weeks, if not to months. But then beyond that, you have a more severe injuries, a moderate to severe severity. And just as I mentioned earlier, how our brain follows the same physiological principles as other body parts, if something is injured severely enough, then unfortunately it will not recover. And so we can see certain injuries where people will not recover. But at the same time, you also have to hold out hope. Look at Gabby Giffords, who had a severe a brain injury from a penetrating head wound, a gunshot wound. And she is showing remarkable recovery because the brain does have tremendous capabilities to regrow connections and make new connections and regrow synapses. But as we go along the continuum of brain injury severity, there are certain injuries that will never recover. But in concussions, mild traumatic brain injuries, like I mentioned earlier, the overwhelming majority of these injuries will experience a full and successful recovery.
Okay. Martin from San Francisco is also on the line. Welcome, Martin, to City Visions.
Thank you. I'm a retired preventive dentist, a KALW and an KNBR listener.
All right.
I have not heard anybody talk about putting the outside of the helmets. They're hard, very hard. They don't break. Why don't they make a sponge?
Okay, that's a really good question.
Helmet, we're sponge against sponge.
So you want to know, you want to understand why they're using hard helmets. Ben, can you take this one?
One of the issues with having a soft helmet like the caller proposed is that it's not a slick surface. So if you have two billiard balls hitting together, they slide. But when you have a spongy surface and it's tacky, they could also make the neck twist a certain way. They don't just bounce off of one another. It can create tremendous torque, broken necks, things like that. So I think the spongy surface is a bit of an issue. And I think there is a lot to be done in terms of helmet technology. But I think that the spongy, tacky surface is one that's going to be tough to get around.
Okay. And Eric, do you think, I mean, have helmets really helped? My understanding is that they really haven't that much. They've actually given false security.
Right. Well, on the whole, technology, as far as equipment technology, has not kept pace with the increase in size and speed that players have grown over the generations. Players are hitting at the high school, college, and professional level. They're moving at greater speeds, greater velocities, and hitting with much greater force than they have generations ago. And technology really hasn't kept pace with that. Helmets are designed to prevent catastrophic brain injuries, skull fractures, hemorrhages, things that can be life-threatening. But they actually do very little, whether it's a football helmet, bike helmet, soccer headgear, what have you. They do very little to actually prevent concussions, to prevent that brain from rocking around inside of the skull.
So, do you think it's a false security? I mean, is it?
Well, it's not a false security from the standpoint of they're needed to prevent real significant catastrophic brain injuries. A bike helmet, I make my kids wear a bike helmet every time they go out on their bike. It's absolutely necessary. But it's a false sense of security if you think that a helmet is going to protect you from a concussion, because they're really not designed to do that.
Okay. Let me put on, we have a couple, again, more callers here. Let me take Skip. Skip from Oakland. Hi, Skip. How are you? Welcome to City Visions.
Yeah. I was just pointing out personal feelings about things. I wanted to say kudos to Stanford for holding Osuo, I think his name was, out
Chris.
Of the game.
Chris Owusu.
After he'd been hit several times. And, you know, after watching the replays over and over again, just sort of cringed because you watched him sort of turn into a sort of a wet Muppet there for a while. And then also the fact that, I'm a 49er fan, and watching that hit in the first 2 minutes on the Saints receiver was awesome. But at the same time, you know, you sort of cringe because you could watch him again sort of limp out because of the hit. So
it's interesting. I like how you had the two, you know, you had the different emotions, and I think that's probably what a lot of people are feeling. Thank you so much for that call, Skip. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the impact of sports-related head injuries and the kind of efforts that Bay Area medical practitioners are taking. Joining me are Cindy Chang, Chief Medical Officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic Team in London, President of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and former Head Physician of the Cal Athletic Department. Dr. Eric Freitag, Founder and Executive Director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center, and Ben Lynch, former Cal and NFL offensive lineman and also a former 49er. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, we'd love to hear from people that watch football, play football, and, you know, or have concerns about any other sports and the kind of concussions that might happen. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let me go to Grant from Sunnyvale. Good evening, Grant.
Good evening. I was calling to ask about the brain injury itself. I heard that there are things that you can do after the brain injury has happened as far as resting the brain, et cetera, but are there any actual drugs that are able to mend the brain itself to expedite the healing of the brain? And I have another question after that, if possible.
Okay. Well, Cindy Chang?
Yes. A lot of, really, we try to control the symptoms after a concussion. And as research in terms of actual drugs that can help to mend the brain or heal the brain, that stuff, we're still researching a lot of that. And some early drugs have come out, and neurologists, in concert with primary care sports physicians, have attempted to try to use some of these medications, but in no way does it mean that they can go back to activity sooner. If they still have the symptoms and we're still using the medications to control the symptoms, we still won't let them go back to activity until they've been off the medications and they've shown that even off the medications, they won't have the symptoms. So, for example, early on, we may have patients that have a hard time sleeping. They have insomnia. So we may use some medications to help them, because without their brain being able to rest and have restful sleep, then it's harder for that brain to recover. But certainly, we don't keep those our patients on that medication, hopefully not long term, because we want to make sure that they're going to be able to recover and come back to activity without that. So there's certain medications out there, but again, we don't use it so that we can return them back to activity.
Is that different, Cindy, from other sort of injuries that people have? I mean, would you give, if it was a knee injury, for example, would you let someone that had a knee injury go, you know, kind of give them pain medicine and throw them out back on the field?
Well, Ben knows very well that I don't throw people back out on the field, but certainly there are modalities and medications that we'll use for a soft tissue injury, for example, so that if someone has sprained a knee, certainly we may start with ice. On the sideline, we may give them anti-inflammatories to help with the pain and the swelling. But whether or not they can return back to activity is really going to be whether or not they can function on the field, they can function on that basketball court, et cetera, and keep themselves safe and not risk further injury. And we can also brace that. So it's a different concept, because the brain is much different than a sprained ligament, much more different than a sprained ligament.
Okay. And Ben, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I want to add one thing that Joe Horn, who is a former NFL receiver, he played for the Chiefs and for the Saints as well. He recently filed a lawsuit against the NFL alleging that a systemic anti-inflammatory drug, is that right, Toradol?
Yes.
Systemic anti-inflammatory drug called Toradol actually masked the effects or the symptoms of concussions, and that he played through them, and probably the symptoms that he suffered were made worse because of the systemic anti-inflammatory.
Okay, well, let me, you know, it's interesting. We have Nick on the line, and he has a really interesting question, which takes us to the other side of football. Nick, well, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. My question is, you know, as we're learning more about brain injuries and concussions, you know, I mean, you see people, I think, was it Javed Best or Mashan, who was really knocked out completely this, really, a lot of the year. But I'm wondering, will that increase then, say, the size of the team so that there's more replacements and there's more substitutions so people can have a real rest within those, especially football, but also probably in hockey and some other sports? And then one other question for the Olympics is, if you have people in concussions, are you going to pull them from matches, say, in wrestling coming up?
Those are great questions, Nick. Ben?
You know, one issue with the NFL is that you have a 53-man roster, so you're paying 53 players, but on game day, you deactivate 8 players, so only 45 actually suit up for a game. One suggestion that I would have going forward would be to suit up all 53 players. Oftentimes, with such a limited roster of 45 players, you're asking a player to go back into the game after they suffered an injury, whether it be an ankle injury, a knee injury, or a head injury. So I think if you play all 53 men that you're paying, that would be a step in the right direction, and expanding rosters would be a step in the right direction. One other thing where the NFL is really behind the times, and I'm surprised this wasn't addressed in the latest collective bargaining agreement, is that there's no short-term disabled list in the NFL. You're either on the roster or you're on injured reserve, and you can't be on injured reserve for 2 weeks. Once you're placed on injured reserve, there's no coming back to the roster. So I think there needs to be some way to address head injuries and injuries in general with the short-term disabled list, whether it's a 10-day disabled list, a 2-week disabled list. But unfortunately, I think some of the drama and the appeal of NFL games and football in general is the gladiator mentality of playing through injuries, which we're quickly finding out is very detrimental to your health.
Now, Cindy, do you find that, do you think that, I guess two questions for you. First of all, as you are sitting at the top, you know, like thinking about rules, changes, policies, I mean, do you consider the kind of business side of things in terms of like how many players? Does that fall into the kind of recommendations that you're making?
It's, you'll look at rosters themselves and you can see that the teams have had more of one at one position or other depending on, I believe, the risks of injury. And so teams are kind of making those decisions themselves. We can certainly add to that, but you are limited by the NFL, you're limited by the NCAA in terms of how many people you can have on the roster. And so you'll hear coaches say about, well, you know, a running back, they're a few downs, and there may be teams that have smaller running backs and therefore they share responsibilities versus someone who's much stronger of a running back and he's going to be taking a lot more of those snaps. Yeah. And so you see that happening, and coaches make those decisions and they're aware. And I just want to point out the athlete was Javid Best with Detroit, and he was a Cal athlete and not Marshawn in terms of this past year. And Javid's been out since his most recent head injury. So I think, again, that the NFL was making changes, albeit, you know, they're definitely responding to what's been out there in terms of trying to educate and do more in terms of their medical staff. And they just actually passed, I don't know if it's a law or regulation, that all the new medical team physicians that are being hired now by the teams have to have a fellowship in sports medicine, and which is really great, because in the past, team physicians would be chosen and not necessarily based on that criteria. So that's a step in the right direction. Some of the things they have in NFL form, that's a step in the right direction. But in terms of policy and things like that, sometimes that's at a level beyond what we could impact and influence,
okay,
certainly. And I do have colleagues that have gone before Congress. I have colleagues that have really done a lot for legislation. But in the end, it comes back to grassroots education. And that's what we're trying to do locally here in the Bay Area, is really educate not only, again, the athletes, the coaches, the parents, families, but also all the primary care physicians, the pediatricians and the family physicians that these kids are going to go to after they've had an injury, and we need them to make sure that they're very comfortable managing concussions.
I want to go to the other question that the caller had about the Olympic athletes and how that might be different. They don't get a next game. It's like it's next 4 years. So how are you in terms of who to pull and who not to pull when it comes to the Olympics?
Well, that's a really great question. And certainly I am working with the CDC in terms of trying to get the educational program out to our Olympians as well. The CDC has great literature on their website, and I encourage anyone who's listening to go to that website and to also go to cifstate.org. They also have good information on concussions for people who want more information. You know, an elite athlete is an elite athlete, and although the Olympics come every 4 years, there are world championships in between. There are other events on the world stage that our elite athletes for USA, Team USA, are participating in. And certainly it still comes down to what I recall Ben saying to me in an earlier conversation. He didn't even know about concussions. And the fact is that we have to make sure that all of our athletes are educated on sports-related concussions, what it means, what the risks are, and the benefits. And certainly the staff that we will have in London are all also going to be well-versed on that, and we work as a team. So anytime that we end up disqualifying an athlete from competition, we'll make that decision as a team with that athlete and the coach involved in that decision-making process.
Okay, let me go to another caller. We have Tom from Moraga. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
My question deals with a computer-based study that is administered to the athletes before the high school season. It's called IMPACT, in which that computer base is drawn on their cognitive skills, and then if they are injured during the season, the test is administered again at a laptop computer. If any of your people there tonight are familiar with this program at all.
Yeah, I think that would be Eric. Eric, is that your you implement this program, correct?
Yeah, that is a program that I use in my clinic. I do what's called baseline testing, which is a computerized test. I happen to use the IMPACT, but there is about four or five other ones on the market. And we do baseline testing, which is pre-injury neurocognitive testing. And then if that athlete should then become injured, we would re-evaluate them using the same test. And allows us to determine the severity of the injury and also able to monitor their recovery. And this it's an important tool in the management of these injuries. It is one piece of the puzzle. It allows us to get objective information about whether or not the brain is injured, how injured it is, and able to monitor recovery. Whereas previously these injuries were managed very subjectively, we would have to rely on the athlete's self-report of their symptoms. And as we know, athletes, I did when I played, oftentimes lied about their symptoms, or we would minimize our symptoms. And that type of management approach can put athletes at risk. So the more that we can do to provide an objective metric, the safer we are going to be able to make return to play decisions. And so that not only involves neurocognitive testing, but it involves balance testing, other neurological testing, and sometimes brain imaging if that's necessary.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you see? Does the brain imaging, the MRIs, does that provide a more accurate picture of what's going on? Even though maybe if the baseline testing, you know, might give some certain information about the MRI, do you think that really can give you a Eric or Cindy?
Just real quickly, that's a great question. A concussion is not a structural injury. So in the overall majority of cases, brain imaging such as a CT scan or MRI are going to be completely normal. In fact, you hear it on TV, well, their CT scan was normal, so they must be okay. It could not be any further from the truth. A concussion injury happens on a microscopic level. Where we would use imaging, and Cindy can speak to this more as a physician, but CT scans in the event we want to rule out a brain bleed or skull fracture. And then typically we'll use advanced imaging like an MRI later on in the recovery process if, for example, it's what we call protracted recovery where symptoms just aren't going away. So we want to get a picture of that brain to make sure that there is no other sort of pathology or structural abnormalities going on that we want to rule out.
Okay. And Cindy, do you want to add to that? Have you used it differently?
Or? Totally agree with Eric. I mean, by definition, a mild traumatic brain injury or sports-related concussion, they don't have changes on imaging studies. I do want to point out with the use of neuropsychological testing computerized that our Tom, I believe, from Moraga was talking about, there, I want our listeners to know as well is that not only does the NFL utilize programs such as that, and at the college level, Cal has been using that as well, but now we're able to, a lot of high schools are doing it, and Wells Fargo, I encourage people who have kids in high school, Wells Fargo is offering a program that they're offering low cost, the same baseline test to high schools in the area, in the state of California, and people can look at that as well in terms of an option. But again, it's very challenging to implement these types of programs at high school institutions that don't have an athletic trainer that's there or someone there to help with this program. We can do it at the college level because we have the programs. You know, Eric is able to do that, and some physicians are able to do it, and of course the NFL or the NHL. But at the high school level, it's more challenging to do that because there are no athletic trainers at most of the high schools in California to help monitor that program and administer to our high school student athletes.
Yeah, it sounds like you really need the whole pick, all the pieces to
ideally
make it work out.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me take the last caller for this evening. We're almost at the top of the hour. We have Daniel from Berkeley. Good evening, Daniel.
Hi. Hello. So just randomly a few years ago, I ran into a neurosurgeon or a neurologist. I can't remember exactly, but he was a doctor who, you know, worked on people's brains. And I don't know how we got talking about this, but he started talking about the moves that cheerleaders do, and they throw them way up in the air, and then they let them fall, and they catch them. And that he had noticed symptoms, or had heard, read reports about symptoms. Again, this guy's a doctor, so he wasn't sort of talking off the top of his head. He said of cheerleaders, you know, having symptoms of kind of disorientation and other not great symptoms of their brain, you know, kind of being compromised after doing a lot of these extreme moves. And you talked to me about, you know, brain slamming into the skull.
Sure.
And it sounds like exactly what you're talking about. And I've been thinking about that for years. It's been in my head. And I thought, wow, I really have to call in.
Thank you for calling in. No, that's a great question. Let me ask Eric. So can cheerleaders get the same kind of concussion or brain injury from the
Well, I think
sense they do.
I think looking at it from a broader picture, and we talked a lot about football, and in some respects, we kind of picked on football quite a bit during this hour. But it really is all sports. Certainly, the collision sports and contact sports are going to have the higher incidence. But cheerleaders are a very high risk. I believe they're called flyers, the ones that fly through the air and they hit the ground. I don't know if the actual just being caught in the air will cause a concussion. I doubt that. But certainly being falling to the ground without being caught can certainly cause a concussion. And I have seen cheerleaders. I've seen a rower before who the oar, what they called, they caught a crab and the oar got stuck and it hit her in the face. So these no one's immune to these. You know, brain injuries can happen in any sport. Certainly some are more prevalent. And it's just important that we know whatever sport they happen in that they're managed and treated properly.
Would that be true of mountain biking too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, any sport where you have to wear a helmet, your brain is at risk. Uh-huh.
Okay, and Eric, do you have any more thoughts on...
One thing I wanted to add was the fact that when we talk about different sports, and yes, head injuries can occur in basketball, mountain biking, cheerleading, any sport, but with football, it's the norm to get hit in the head play after play after play after play, and it's almost we compared head injuries to injuries in other parts of the body, and one of my concerns as I get older is that... If you're hitting yourself in the head over and over and over again, is it like picking a scab and never giving your brain a chance to heal? And I think that's why football needs to be looked at a little bit differently, and maybe rugby needs to be looked at a little bit differently than when we talk about basketball, where concussions happen on a less frequent basis, or maybe baseball, where they happen on a less frequent basis as well.
Yeah, good point. Cindy, do you agree with that?
I do, and back to the caller's question, the athlete has to be prepared to play their sport. And I think that I covered cheerleading at Ohio State, where I was a team physician before I came to Cal, and that was definitely full of stunts, full of pyramids, etc. Coming to Cal, they have a dance team, so it's a much different situation. But you have to be prepared to play your sport. It means you have to have the strength. You have to, and I think what the caller was saying is just by simple virtue of doing those tumbling or doing those spins in the air and then being caught. Yeah, you could probably have whiplash if you're caught incorrectly or you're not strong enough in the neck muscles and the core with that. But that's why, as an athlete, you need to be prepared to play that sport. And think about gymnasts. We have very few concussions in gymnasts, and they're always doing a lot of rotations up in the air, etc. So again, in a high level gymnast, you're not going to find those types of issues. So again, that's part of the preventive, is making sure that you have that body type, you have that preparation to be able to play that sport and to play it well.
So just, we're at the top of the hour, and I think that you're, you know, saying that the athlete needs to be prepared, and you know, the awareness, with the awareness as being one of the big things. What about for parents that have children that want to get involved in sports? Is there any tips, like just a couple of tips you could give parents who are watching children and trying to size up, you know, who maybe aren't as communicative about they and aren't taking the baseline test?
Find a good coach who is willing to take the time to teach technique and to stress skill and teamwork and competition above winning. Because that's not what's important at an early age, nor even at the high school level. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned by playing sports. But honestly, and make sure that your child really wants to play that sport, that it's not something that they're just choosing because they feel like it's the pure thing to do.
Well, fantastic. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dr. Cindy Chang, Chief Medical Officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic team in London and President of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine and former head physician of the Cal Athletic Department. Dr. Eric Freitag, Founder and Executive Director for the Mount Diablo Memory Center. And Ben Lynch, former Cal and NFL offensive lineman. For a link to, first of all, thank you all so much. This is a fantastic show.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having us.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Thank you so much, Eric. Tonight's show producer was Matt Fiddler. Matt, fantastic. Thank you. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Judith Sanson is the senior producer, and our other contributing producers are Susie Britton, Lisa Denmark, and Victoria Thorpe. Tune into City Visions next week, where we'll take you to the theater and explore the decline in attendance. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.